from West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
West Virginia University, online at wvu.edu. AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/wv. The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually in our state by 2025. Through increased opportunities for West Virginians to earn the credentials today's economy demands. The High Technology Foundation, building a stronger West Virginia, online at wvhtf.org.
At the legislature today, Democratic senators attempt to slow down a bill to repeal the state's prevailing wage, but we ask our guests tonight what potential impact that bill could have on West Virginia's economy. The House approves a critical funding bill after days of debate, and we are joined by the health chairs to discuss one of West Virginia's biggest issues, substance abuse. Those stories and more coming up on the legislature today. Good evening, I'm Ashton Mara. Members of the West Virginia Senate are still on track to vote on a repeal of the state's prevailing wage Thursday. That after a Democratic senator tried one last time today to have a fiscal note prepared for the bill, and another attempted to kill it. Here's what happened on the Senate floor today.
Ms. President, point of order.
Democratic Senator John Unger of Berkeley County raised the issue on the chamber floor Tuesday over House Bill 4005, a bill to repeal the state's prevailing wage. The wage is the hourly rate of pay and benefits workers are paid on state construction jobs. Monday, a member of the chamber had asked for a fiscal note for the bill. That note explains the impact a piece of legislation may have on the state's budget, but the request was denied. So Unger again attempted to obtain a note, citing Senate rules.
So, Mr. President, I'm calling upon you, as president of your office, to exercise your duties to uphold the Senate rules in the sense that there is evidently a fiscal note because all the information's available. I ask that that be given to the members and also allow for the public to know exactly what the cost is.
Republicans oppose the motion, including Senate Judiciary Chair Charles Trump.
Rule 15A is quite explicit. In order for the requirement of a fiscal note to apply, the bill must either increase or decrease the revenue or fiscal liability of the state or one of its political subdivisions. This bill, the bill being reported from the Committee on Government Organization, does not increase the revenue of the state or the fiscal liability of the state or of any political subdivision.
Senate President Bill Cole ruled against the motion denying the fiscal note, but Unger challenged that ruling, asking for a full vote of the body. The request died on a party line vote, just as it had Monday. Senate Minority Leader Jeff Kessler then attempted to kill the bill.
The senator from Marshall moves to reject House Bill 4005.
Kessler says for the second year in a row, his constituents are asking him to block the repeal. His fellow Democrats joined him, including Senator Bob Beach of Monongalia County.
We heard the position of the president here earlier today that, in fact, this piece of legislation was revenue neutral. It had no impact one way or the other. So I'm asked the simple question, and this is the only question I have, is why are we pursuing this piece of legislation? Why do we not dispose of it right now if it has no impact on what we're doing here in the state of West Virginia?
Republicans yet again spoke against the motion to reject the bill. Senator Greg Boso is from Nicholas County.
I stand representing the people of the 11th Senatorial District, all of the people, not just the contractors. I represent the people that are working at home in the grocery stores, that are working in the car lots, that are working in the convenience stores. I represent all of the people. They struggle to put two ends together at home. We've protected a class of people within the state of West Virginia for way too long. It's time for us to take off the protection for one particular class at the expense of all the others.
Senators voted on party lines against Kessler's motion to kill House Bill 4005. The full chamber is expected to put the bill to a vote Thursday.
The fight over prevailing wage in the state house is one that's largely political, but is based on one fundamental question. Will a repeal of the wage help or hurt the state's economy? Tonight we pose that question to our guests. Sean O'Leary is a senior policy analyst for the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy. John Deskins is the director of the West Virginia University Bureau of Business and Economic Research. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
So let's start with that question. Will the prevailing wage, will a repeal of the prevailing wage help or hurt the state's economy? Sean?
Well, we have a lot of experience and a lot of data and reports from other states that have looked at this issue, that have repealed the prevailing wage, that have enacted prevailing wage. And what we've found and what the evidence strongly suggests is that repealing the prevailing wage really isn't going to lower costs. It really isn't going to save the state any money, but could do some actual harm to the economy by lowering wages in the construction industry and in turn resulting in a workforce that has less skills and less experience. And when you have a less skilled, less experienced workforce and you have lower wages, that's not good news for the economy.
John, I'm going to ask you to respond to some of that, but let's start with this larger question. Does it help or hurt West Virginia?
Sure, I'd like to just step back just for a second and think about, you know, what is the real proper role of government? So we have to provide infrastructure, education, other factors that make that enable the free market to flourish in a state, in an economy. So in providing these public goods and services like transportation infrastructure, we want the executive branch to have flexibility. We want the executive to be able to weigh different options that are available in the market. Maybe this contractor has lower prices and lower quality. Maybe that contractor has higher prices and higher quality. And the executive should be able to make the determination which is going to be best for the taxpayer, the citizen of West Virginia. So it seems strange to me in some ways that we would bind our hands and require a certain wage to be paid. It's not consistent with the notion that we have flexibility to weigh all of our options and determine, even on a case-by-case basis, what is best for our state. Why bind our hands in this way? A household wouldn't want to do that. A business wouldn't want to do that. Why do we want our state government to be bound? Potentially there won't be any effect. Potentially we'll just find that what we're doing now makes sense. But we have, without a prevailing wage, we have much more flexibility.
So, Sean, can I ask you to respond to that? Because you say there's a possibility we could see it lower the wage rate overall in the state.
Exactly, and that's because the government doesn't have that flexibility. The government is required to accept the lowest bid. And when the government is required to accept the lowest bid on these public projects, the easiest way to get that lowest bid is sometimes to undercut the wages and bring out outside sources of labor that can undercut the local economy. And that's exactly why we had the prevailing wage, to make sure that we're having a level playing field and that the government isn't distorting the market by requiring that lowest bid, that the wages being paid on the projects are what are being paid in the local market, in the economy at large. And that way the government ensures that we are the contractors and the bids are being competed on who can produce the highest quality, who can be most productive, who can be most efficient with our taxpayer dollars, not just who can compete on who has the lowest wages.
I had the chairs of the government organization committees on yesterday to talk about this issue, and they both say this will save the taxpayer money in the end. Mm-hmm. It won't lower wages, but we're going to see savings. John, do you believe that's true?
I think we very well could see savings. Any reduction in wages, I mean, those wages aren't coming from nowhere. They're coming from the taxpayers' dollars. Any savings that we get in lower wages can be reinvested in the state in terms of more funding for more infrastructure. Lord knows we need more better infrastructure in the state. It can be reinvested in education and a whole host of different areas. So any reduction in wages, don't just think the money that's going to pay these wages comes from thin air. It's all a trade-off. Any dollar saved in wages can be reinvested in more schools, more infrastructure. I mean, there's a lot of positives there, a lot of potential.
Do you think we'll see those savings, Sean?
I really don't think so, and I think we can look at states like Kentucky, like Ohio, like Maryland, like New Mexico, like Michigan, who have all not seen these savings appear when they've modified or changed or repealed the prevailing wage laws. What they've seen is a workforce that is less experienced, less skilled, and less productive and less efficient when the taxpayers are spending their money on these public construction projects.
So, John, we've only got about a minute left, but you worked on the recalculation. Last year, they compromised. They decided, we'll just recalculate the wage rate, and we'll put that in place. Why were they not satisfied with the process? Do you think the state could have stuck with that recalculation?
Certainly we could have, but again, that's not consistent with what I said a second ago with the notion of why would we bind our hands in this way? Why don't we want to keep our options open? But with the recalculation, the original idea there was that we would use the calculation based largely on BLS data, and Workforce West Virginia ultimately decided to go with a calculation that was based more largely on survey data, which was more similar in some ways to the old approach. I think the much more fundamental and more interesting question myself is why have a prevailing wage at all, though? Why bind their hands in this way? A household wouldn't want to do it. A business wouldn't want to do it. Why do we want to put that on the executive branch of our government?
Well, they will be taking a vote on Thursday, and I'm sure we'll get an answer. Mm-hmm. Sean O'Leary, John Deskins, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
We return to Western West Virginia tonight for another installment of Meet Your Lawmaker.
Mike Woeffel is a Democrat representing the state's 5th Senatorial District. A Democrat, he's from Campbell County. Senator Woeffel was elected to the Senate in 2014. Doug Reynolds represents the state's 17th House District. He's a Democrat from Campbell County and was elected to the House in 2006. Before the Republican majority took over the House in 2015, Reynolds served as the vice chair of the House Committees on Finance and Banking. Matthew Rohrbach was elected to the House of Delegates in 2014 to represent the 17th District. He's a Republican from Campbell County. Delegate Rohrbach works as a physician and was named a Knight of the Golden Horseshoe. Kelly Sabonia is a Republican from Campbell County. She was elected to represent the 18th House District in 2002. Delegate Sabonia serves as the Assistant Majority Whip. She also chairs the House Committee on Rulemaking Review and is the Vice Chair of the Industry and Labor Committee.
Almost every state agency has been asked once again by Governor Tomlin to cut their budgets this year. The Department of Health and Human Resources announced a bill today they'll propose to lawmakers that attempts to offset some of its cuts in the public health sector. Beth Voorhees explains.
You know, as we tighten our belt, we also have to think.
Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Resources Karen Bowling announced the proposed legislation during a press conference Tuesday. The bill, which Bowling says will be introduced in both chambers, will relieve some of the regulatory burden on local county health departments who want to bill insurance companies. Health departments are currently allowed under state code to bill for the services they provide, but Bowling says there's often red tape that makes it difficult to complete the process. Removing some of those burdens, she hopes, will allow the subsidized public health providers to look to private dollars to supplement their budgets.
You know, we all have to tighten our belt during a time when there's a budget crisis, and I think that in our case, we're coming up with a solution that we think is going to be beneficial to try to offset some of those cuts.
If the bill is approved by lawmakers, Bowling estimates local health departments could bill insurance companies for nearly $8 million annually, more than making up for the governor's proposed $4 million in cuts. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Beth Voorhees in Charleston.
Funding for healthcare programs across West Virginia and the impact that will have on the state's health outcomes is one issue our next guest will certainly have to consider this legislative session. We're joined tonight by the chairs of the House and Senate Health Committees, Senator Ryan Ferns and Delegate Joe Ellington. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with what we saw in that last story. $4 million in cuts to local county health departments proposed by the governor. Can the legislature find solutions to help these local departments, or are you all focused on letting the agency figure it out? Delegate?
Well, we're looking at both ways. We want the agency to look at how they can trim down what their expenses are, but they're also looking at being able to bill for different services they provide that they haven't done before. The legislature is always looking at different ways of revenue streams and how we can work on efficiency and improvement.
So this bill will be presented to both chambers, and you all plan to take a look at those in your committee?
Yes, both of us are sponsors in our respective houses.
Okay. Let's move on to a Senate bill. Senate Bill 10 is an abortion bill that deals with dismemberment, and it was pulled from the committee last week after a similar bill was declared unconstitutional in a different state. Are you still going to run that build, Senator?
We are. We plan to have that on our agenda this week, and we just want to do our due diligence. You know, any time that another state takes an action like that, I think it's, you know, incumbent upon us to do our homework and make sure that there's not something that we're missing. But that is, that was not the Kansas Supreme Court, but rather an intermediary court. You know, of course, our laws in the state of West Virginia are different regardless. So, but we just wanted to give ourselves the time to consider that fully.
Maybe I should ask you to explain the bill a little bit so that our audience is clear on what it actually does.
Well, the bill is titled Prevention of Abortion Dismemberment. And so essentially in the second trimester, there is a procedure done by physicians for abortions that is in some cases recommended, and I think it's primarily emergency type situations, and my colleague here who's in that field could probably correct me if I'm wrong, but essentially it is making that type of procedure illegal.
So Delegate, we should ask you that question because you are an OBGYN. So tell me about this bill. Do you think it's necessary for the state of West Virginia?
There are components to both parts of that. The procedure that the Senator was just referring to is called a D&E or dilation evacuation. That's the normal procedure that's used in the second trimester, especially in the tertiary centers. That obviously dismembers, and it's more of a destructive procedure to remove a fetus from the mom. There are pharmacologic ways in which to do that too, not always effective. They're not necessarily the standard of care at this point, but that the bill would suffice to have that done. So there are ways to get around that, but we also want to protect the providers and also take care of the women as far as how to do the procedure correctly.
Well, let's move on to an issue that is, it affects every region of West Virginia, almost every West Virginian's life, and that's substance abuse. The state has a big problem with drug abuse in the state. Delegate, you're now chairing a new committee to focus on the substance abuse issue. What kind of work will you all be doing?
A number of things we're looking at. Speaker Armstead had selected that committee, and he handpicked a lot of the people to be on that, and I'm honored to be chair of that. But a number of things we're looking at is a wide range of things, from prevention to treatment, but also identification and intervention when necessary. So we're open to all topics, and we're exploring a number of different things. We actually had one of our second meeting today where we were able to move a couple of bills through the
Can you give me an example of maybe a specific that you all looked at?
Yes, there was one bill that was built on last year's. We had on the Vivitrol, where in the penal system, where members could be placed on Vivitrol to help get them back into work-related options. The regional jails and correctional facilities asked to be added to that pilot study. We've already had some positive results since last year. They've asked to be part of that, and we think that'll also help. We also looked at different options on methadone regulation, because we have a number of methadone clinics in the state, and we're trying to get a better handle on that, because that seems to be proliferating.
So we should just say quickly that drugs like methadone, Suboxone, Vivitrol, they're used medically to help wean people off of drugs.
They are, but they don't necessarily always wean them off. And especially, particularly with the methadone clinics, we have people who have been on that for years, and we're trying to get a better handle on trying to get them off of that.
Senator, one of the first bills your committee took on was drug testing for TANF recipients. Can you talk to me about that bill? You all passed it out already.
Yes, we did, and it was a top priority, not just for my committee, but for our entire caucus in the Senate. And really, we look at this as a compassionate way to identify individuals who are in need of help. We have this population who we are already assisting, who are already going through our system. And so, and actually, the Department of Health and Human Resources is already pretty well set up to do this sort of testing. And so, it's just a compassionate means for identifying individuals who need help and then getting them that help. And it's a kind of a three strikes you're out system. And in the first strike, the individuals don't actually lose any benefits, but instead, as long as they participate in a drug treatment and job training program, they're able to continue to receive those benefits. So we're giving them a direct incentive to get help.
So, Delegate, I'm assuming that this committee will come to, excuse me, that this bill will come to your committee as well. Does the state have the resources
to put this program together, to make it work?
I believe they do. We're waiting for it to come from the Senate. It's currently in Senate Finance. We have a sister bill in the House that we're holding back on until we get the Senate bill. But yes, we do have the resources. The fiscal note was not very much in the big scheme of things. We're looking at targeting, or let's say narrowing, the cohort that we're looking for to try to get them back off of any substance abuse. And then again, the key is to protect the families, the children, get them back, make sure that the children are in a good environment. We're also trying to get those members back into society as far as being productive so they can provide for their families. So it's pretty much trying to identify and intervene in one of the few topics that the state has some control over.
Senator, we've got about a minute left, but I want to ask you about an announcement that President Obama made today. He'll present $1 billion in his budget, his 2017 budget, to help expand access to substance abuse treatment. I think we can assume that some of that money will come to the state of West Virginia. That's money that we're desperately in need of.
Absolutely.
Will you all look for that kind of help from the federal government?
Absolutely. I mean, we are going to pursue all options. And as you've mentioned, I mean, this is an issue that's gripping our entire state. And of course, with the extremely difficult financial situation that our state is in, we will absolutely pursue any avenue to help the people of West Virginia.
Senator Ferns, Delegate Ellington, chairs of the House and Senate Health Committees, thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
The House Industry and Labor Committee took up a bill today that makes it clearer who an accident on a natural gas well site or a pipeline should be reported to. Liz McCormick has more.
House Bill 4323 was introduced on behalf of Governor Tomlin. It requires all emergency incidents on well sites or pipelines be reported to the West Virginia Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management within 15 minutes. This bill came as a result of a special commission set up by the governor in spring 2015 to review and update existing laws and regulations governing the state's oil and natural gas industry. Larry Malone is the director of policy for Governor Tomlin and is the chairman of the West Virginia Commission on Oil and Natural Gas Industry Safety.
The commission that the governor established looked into safety issues in the oil and gas industry. One of the recommendations that came out of it was the requirement that pipeline operators and drilling operators, if they have an incident, and the incident is defined as if someone has been killed or serious injury or there's a serious situation involving public safety, that they call the state and notify the state within 15 minutes of that incident.
However, if that well or pipeline operator does not report the incident within that time frame, there's a fine involved of $50,000. Some delegates in the Industry and Labor Committee were concerned about the high fee for such a short amount of time given to report an incident. So Delegate John Schott of Mercer County recommended an amendment. The change would allow the director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management to assess a fine between $2,500 and $50,000 for not reporting the incident. The committee voted unanimously in favor of the amendment. Malone says it adds flexibility, but it doesn't hurt the integrity of the bill.
It doesn't really change the fact that you could be assessed $50,000. It just provides the director with some discretion based upon the situation about whether he assesses the maximum fine or some fine that's in between. But again, to date, nobody has been assessed, no company has been assessed that fine because they have all understood and responded appropriately when they have these types of emergency incidents.
The committee passed House Bill 4323, 16-5. It now moves on to the House Energy Committee before moving on to the House floor for consideration. For the legislature today, I'm Liz McCormick in the House.
Members of the House also approved an appropriations bill requested by Governor Tomlin today. The bill takes $52 million from the state's rainy day fund to balance the 2016 budget. Tomorrow on our show, we'll focus in on education and the issues facing both the K-12 and higher education systems with an interview with the chairs of the House and Senate Education Committees, Senator Dave Seipold and Delegate Paul Espinosa tomorrow. This has been the Legislature Today. I'm Ashton Mara. Thanks for joining us.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
West Virginia University, online at wvu.edu. AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/wv. The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually in our state by 2025. Through increased opportunities for West Virginians to earn the credentials today's economy demands. The High Technology Foundation, building a stronger West Virginia, online at wvhtf.org. From West Virginia Public Broadcasting.